Meeting will come to order. Committee on Public Safety Policy and Finance today, Thursday, March 16th, 2006. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Here.
Representative Eastland?
Here.
Cornish?
Here.
Ellison?
Here.
Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson?
Here.
Nestle?
Here.
Murphy?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Soderstrom?
Here.
Chair notes that we do have the presence of a quorum, so the first item on the agenda would be consideration of the minutes from Wednesday, March 15, 2006. They are in the packet. Is there a motion on the minutes? Representative Meslow moves approval of those minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted.
In order.
All right, members, we have... Members, we're going to proceed, and in order, just a note, members, the item number 8 on the agenda, discussion of House File 3308, if there's time this morning, it would be my intention to simply, for the record, take off the provisions of the bill. If there is not time to do that, we'll do that the second half of Tuesday when we have... a block of time scheduled for presentation and equal blocks of time for testifiers both for and against. So there will be no testimony and no testimony either con or pro on this bill today. I had hoped to be able to do a little presentation at least, but just be aware that while it's on today's calendar, the short story is that it will be heard next Tuesday. So with that, we're going to move along to House File 2916, Fire Safety Fund. Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chair, a few groups contacted me wishing to express and weigh in on this thing. So will they have a chance to testify on this thing next week on Tuesday?
Representative Ellison, yes. I believe it'll be Tuesday next week, probably 4:30, and there will be equal blocks of time to pro and con.
All right. Thank
Depending
you.
On how many are here, it's irrelevant. There will simply be equal blocks of time for pro and con. So the answer is next week's Tuesday at 4:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Room 10, by the way.
10?
And subject to change, room 10.
All right. You want to take the amendment?
We're taking up House File 2916. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would. Thank you. I would like to move that House File 2916 be recommended to pass, and that it be re-referred to the Committee on State Government. Mr. Chairman, give me just a second, please. Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that I'd like to offer. I have copies. Could I get this passed out, please?
Okay, is it one that we have? Do we have it in the packet, or do you have it there? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I apologize for the lateness of the amendment, and Representative Murphy as well. However, this bill has been around since last session, and it's been worked on over the interim, and it's been worked on even for several hours this morning. It probably may need a little additional work, but we're here, I think, with an agreement of the parties involved to make better an existing system by whereby money is acquired through fire insurance premiums. Frankly, I'm going to let Mr. Stockstead, at your pleasure, update us on the contents of the bill and the amendment. So I would like to offer the amendment, but I would like to discuss it first.
Okay, Representative Smith then moves the amendment. I think we've all just about got here. It's amendment, what's the number on it? Amendment AH2916A1.
Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, if Mr. Stockstead could discuss the bill and the amendment in conjunction with the amendment, and then at the appropriate time we'll offer the amendment.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and proceed then, Mr. Stockstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Stockstead. I'm the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association. As Representative explains, this bill has been around, at least in draft in this session, for the last year, and prior to that for the last couple of 3 years in various forms. In this form, we have actually met, had a meeting of the minds, and gotten as many people on board as we possibly can to try and make a piece of good legislation dealing with the fire insurance tax, or what has been known in the past as the fire marshal's tax. Basically, there's currently a collection of 0.5% on your fire insurance premiums on your property taxes and automobile insurance for a fire marshal's tax that was imposed in the early 1900s and then updated in about 1938. At that time, the tax was captured by a fund and it was dedicated specifically to the state fire marshal's office. Over the years, that has changed and has been now goes into the general fund and is part of just the general appropriation value, although the tax is still a fire tax. So what this bill does is it re-recognizes that it first of all repeals the tax, and then it imposes instead a surcharge on the amount of those fire insurance premiums, but it goes back into the dedicated fund for the use for the state fire marshal's office, firefighter training for all the local fire departments throughout the state of Minnesota, as well as some of the regional programs or teams that we have in place that handle fire service issues and fire service programs dealing with emergency response. The funds that are in this account, there's an amount of fund that goes to the revenue for them to actually collect it, catalog it, and handle the funds. The remainder goes into the Department of Public Safety for the fire initiatives. A panel is created to help us oversee, make suggestions to the commissioner before he budgets or allocates these dollars, and that panel is made up of people from within the industry and the insurance side so that they are well aware each and every year of what the upcoming issues are, what the needs are, and can make those recommendations in order those funds can be appropriately allocated.
Representative Smith, did you have...
Mr. Chairman, there are others here who can answer questions, but I hope that's a reasonable summary. If there are questions from the committee, we'll take those now.
Okay, so we'll just, we'll the bill and then the amendment, we'll assume that the amendment's in here, and then we'll make the appropriate motion later. Is that the, so questions on the bill or the amendment? Is that what we're taking now?
Mr. Chairman, let me request that we shift gears. My request would be to process the amendment now so we've got the bill as amended, and then we'll take questions on whatever.
Okay, so Representative Smith is moving the A1 amendment. Are there any questions or comments on the A1 amendment as it's presented here? So all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
I don't know what the amendment does.
Okay, Representative Paymar has a question on the amendment. Let's answer the question before we'll move backwards here. Representative Paymar?
I just want to know what it does.
Representative Smith, Mr. Stockstead. Mr. Stockstead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, what the amendment does in the original language, there was just a flat fee established for the surcharge on the insurance policies of $5.25 per homeowner, irregardless of what your policy was, and then a scale for the commercial policies, depending on how much the premium was, you fell into that scale at some point. The amendment takes that scale out, and it recognizes that it'll be a percentage of whatever the policy is, similar to what we do today as a means of determining the amount of the surcharge.
You represent PMR?
I guess I don't understand the history of all this. So currently there's a fire insurance tax that homeowners pay on their insurance policy. I guess I don't look at my policy very closely. So there's actually a tax there?
Mr. Stockton?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, yes, there is actually a tax there. I don't think it'll show up on your policy. Currently, I think it's just rolled in into the collection of your premium, and then the insurance companies, when they report to the Department of Revenue, have to pay based on what your premium was, and there's a different form that they fill out, so you may not have seen it. This particular provision actually will provide a line on your policy that shows what it is, so you will start to see it.
Representative Smith, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paymar, I'll add to that. It is a tax currently. It was imposed or implemented over 70 years ago. It's just not transparent on people's fire insurance policies. Some people don't pay their fire insurance policy. They pay their mortgage company and its escrow. What this amendment will do is make it a surcharge that is transparent, that people will see it. But it will be, frankly, this amendment is as a result of input, objections and input made by Representative Rukavina in Commerce Committee a few days ago to make the surcharge a more gradated event. So this amendment you see is to do all of the above, including to accommodate Representative Rukavina's argument. Thought they had merit, so we're trying to incorporate those in the bill.
Mr. Chair,
so under the amendment and the bill, is the assessment generating more revenue than the current fire insurance tax?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, it's doing a couple of things. Number one, it's making it a dedicated fund, and it's directing it to the fire marshal as a direct dedicated fund. And the old language in the bill, prior to the amendment, raised roughly $13 million. We don't know precisely what the amended language will do, but the intent is that when the blank line is filled in, that it will be consistent with the goal of raising $13 million.
Representative Paymar, does that answer your question?
Well, at some point, Mr. Chair, after the amendment goes on, I'd like to know what the money gets used for. But I can wait on that.
Okay. Representative Nelson, did you have a question?
Representative Smith answered my question. He said that the blank would be filled, and I was wondering what the blank amount was.
Okay. Representative Murphy, did you?
Not on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so the motion before us is the A1 amendment. Any other questions? All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion is adopted. The amendment is now before us as part of the bill. Representative Smith?
Are we supposed to? Mr. Chairman, I think what I'd like to do is have Mr. Ganfill approach the microphone and testify, which will probably answer Representative Paymar's question as to where the money goes. So I'd like Mr. Ganfield to offer some testimony.
Okay, Mr. Ganfield, welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record and then give us your comments?
Good morning. My name is David Ganfield. I'm the Secretary of the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We've been working on this bill for many years, and actually goes back even further than that. I was elected as Secretary of the State Fire Department Association in 1997. I've been a firefighter for more than 20-some years. An issue back then was training for firefighters, and it has been for years. How are we going to get training to all our firefighters? It was an issue that we were working on in 1997 and did achieve getting a Minnesota Board of Fire Training and Education. That was a priority. However, there's never been funding for that training board, or still nothing for training for firefighters. Recently, in the last 2 years, our association did a survey of our members. We have about 550 member departments out of the nearly 800 that are in the state of Minnesota. The number one priority we came out with was more and better training for firefighters. And that is a goal of our association. What this bill does in one area, it does provide funding for that Board of Fire training and education so they can qualify instructors and get consistent training throughout the state and training for these fire departments. One of the other items that are included in the funding of this bill is to fund the Fire Marshal's Office. There's been a downturn in the amount of services provided, and especially since many of the local governments have lost some of their aid. They're relying on the state for doing more services for them, and it's something that needs to be done, especially for greater Minnesota. What we're seeing is a need there, and what this bill does is it does provide dedicated amounts so that the Fire Marshal's Office and training for firefighters is there and available for their firefighters and for local departments.
Thank you, Mr. Ganfield. Representative Murphy, do you have a question?
I have a question, Representative Smith, about the financing. This dedicated fund will be in addition to the line items and the base amount that the fire department gets. Am I correct? This isn't going to substitute for the base funding to the Department of Public Safety for the fire marshal, is it?
Representative Smith or Mr. Stockstead?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it is actually the intent that the fire marshal's office would in fact be funded out of this and then would not have to go to the general fund looking for an appropriation for the various items that the general fund currently supports. So right now the general fund I believe it's $2.8 million this year for the State Fire Marshal's Office. That would come out of this rather than the general fund.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith. So you anticipate, Representative Smith, that this dedicated fund that's coming from a surcharge on all the people's fire insurance is going to be paying rent for the fire marshal, and it's going to do the usual, ordinary, daily things that any department of the government, other department of the government is paid for from the agency?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, yes. A little more full answer would be, frankly, what we have here is residential and commercial property. How many houses exist? 1.67 million homes in the state pay this already. I'm not aware of the number of businesses. A couple hundred thousand currently pay this amount. The so-called stakeholders involved, everyone who is interested in continuing to receive the funding and do the service for it, has worked up the language to do just that. But to make it a dedicated fund so that it is there in the amount needed to do the job and not subject to the vagaries of biennial tampering.
Representative Murphy.
Representative Smith, do you anticipate that the fire marshal's budget will come before this committee as it has in the past, then, as part of the Department of Public Safety budget? Or will we be giving up our perusal of the budget?
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it is not my intent to cut this committee cut loose of its oversight on that line item. I'll take another look at the language. We have time to double sure, but I don't think there's anything in the language that cuts us loose from the oversight. It's not my intent.
Representative Hilstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Smith, how do you foresee that the transition from what they're doing now to this new fund would take place? Because we'd want to make certain that there was enough revenue to pay rent payments and those kinds of things, and so have you worked out the details on that?
Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom,
if I understand your question, how do we make sure that that nothing breaks down between now and when it's up and running? It becomes effective July of 07. So my guess is, my intent and belief is that the insurance companies and whoever is going to make implement this will do so and maintain the cash flow. I don't anticipate or foresee why this bill by itself, why this bill alone would cause a breakdown in the cash flow when everything else we do does not.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Smith, I'm not anticipating that the money wouldn't eventually be there, but certain people pay their bills at different times, and when you're collecting money from lots of different sources, you ultimately want to make certain that the money has arrived where it needs to be by the date that you need it. And so I don't know if there needs to be an overlap in time to make certain that happened or not, but I just want to make certain that you were aware of that issue.
Thank you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to understand this now. So, Mr. Stockstead, you just said that your biennial budget is $2.8 million. Is that what I understand?
Mr. Stockstead?
Chair, percentage per year.
Per year. Oh, it's per year. So it's, okay, so we're talking roughly about $5 million. And then what additional revenue does the fire chiefs get? Is there any other revenue sources, or is this
Mr. Stockton?
Mr. Sheriff, I'm assuming you mean the Fire Marshal's Office, but additional.
Mm-hmm.
There are some fees that the Fire Marshal does, in fact, get for specific industry or specific property inspections and so forth. There's also some grants or contracts that they have with other agencies. This would not supplant those.
Representative Paymar?
Well, I'm just trying to, it seems like if we do this, which the training needs might be that significant, if I understand the tax that will now be an assessed fee would really generate $26 million over the biennium. Is that correct, or do I have that wrong? It's currently $13 million a year.
Mr. Stockton?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that's correct. We're anticipating a revenue of $13 million per year. We've not gotten the fiscal numbers yet on this. It's been tough to track that. The collection of that particular current tax is off of annual premiums, which is a calendar year versus a fiscal year, and we're tracking that backwards. Regarding the difference in the funding, the fire service receives no support whatsoever from the state of Minnesota regarding the actual fire department operations. So the costs that are involved actually are quite significant. We've broken down the cost of training a new firefighter. It comes to about $3,200 per firefighter. The equipment that you provide a firefighter when they start the job is about $3,200 or $3,000 as well. So an employer or a city has about $6,000 invested at the beginning of each firefighter's term. Now you replace quite a few firefighters a year, so these are ongoing costs. A good portion of the intent with this is that this fire training board would have then some funds that they could reimburse for fire training costs. Obviously, you can't reimburse every community $3,000 per firefighter, but if we could get a couple hundred dollars, per firefighter, or based on how many hours or per hour type of training reimbursement, similar to what the police or the EMS are getting, it would be a significant help for the fire departments that are suffering so greatly today.
If I understand this, and I think that makes sense in light of all the LGA cuts that have been made to our cities, but so you're really going to have an extra around $20 million a biennium for training and if I understand this correctly, you're going to have $20 million in additional money.
Mr. Stockstead?
Mr. Chair, Representative, there could be as much as, $9, $10 million per year, yes. Currently, the tax collects somewhere between $6.9 and $7 million, so it's actually only $4 or $5 million more than it's being collected today today it goes into the general fund. It doesn't come to the fire service. The fire marshal's office gets about 2.8 per year appropriation. The fire marshal's office has been cut significantly over the past few years as well. We are looking to help that agency out in getting back to where they need to be to provide the services to our local communities that they need to provide, the support for our investigations, the support for our training, plan reviews, those types of things that we're lacking today, that need to occur and have occurred in the past. So all of the difference of what we're capturing from the actual tax of the fire tax wouldn't be going directly to training. That's why the committee is in place for this panel, is so that they can evaluate what the actual needs are in a particular given year, so that when the commissioner does formulate that budget, he can have those recommendations from that panel to try and address the needs of the fire service.
I want to belabor this because I'm understanding and I like the concept, but I agree with Representative Murphy and I, in her questioning of you, Representative Smith, to make sure that this committee has oversight over that fund, because the legislature over history has created these dedicated funds and no one seems to know, or it seems that the legislature, the accountability is lacking and the legislature doesn't know what's happening with those funds. So I would hope that I don't know if that's something that can be built into this bill. Some language that would, I understand taking your word on it, Representative Smith, but do you think that there should be some language in the bill?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Smith.
Representative Kamer, that this is a good segue into two more amendments that I just discovered that I have. But first of all, I want to thank both of you. I prefer to get questions and things asked in committee rather than have any surprises on the floor, Representative Paymar. So let's go to the two amendments.
I rarely have surprises.
Mr. Chair, you go to the A5 amendment first? The A5 amendment is the one with the carryover and the reporting requirements.
Has that been distributed?
It's in the packets, I think. You should have an A5 amendment in your packet. We'll take that up at this time. Representative Smith, do you have that in front of you?
Yes. The A5 amendment, I'd like to move that amendment.
Okay.
And this is as a result of the concern just discussed, not only here but elsewhere by other representatives. I think Representative Loeffler brought it up in Commerce. I'm not sure. But it would have the effect of providing the accounting.
Okay, Representative Smith moves the A5 amendment. Any questions or discussion at this point? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment's adopted. We have one more amendment, the A4 amendment. Do you want to
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the A4 amendment. Provides for a little more diversity, if you will, geographically for the members of the advisory committee, to include at least three be residing in counties outside the seven county metropolitan area. Again, in response to, I think Representative Loeffler brought this up elsewhere, and I thought it was a good idea, so we'd like to accommodate that.
Okay, Representative Smith moves the A4 amendment. Any questions on the A4 amendment? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Any other questions on the bill as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to renew my motion that the bill be recommended to pass, be re-referred to State Government Committee.
Okay, before we take action, is there anybody in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Do we want to just raise your hand quickly? Seeing none, then we will move ahead and proceed. So Representative Smith renews his motion that the House File 2916, as amended, pass and be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the motion is adopted. The bill is passed and moves out of here. Okay, the next bill we're going to take is also Representative Smith's bill. It's an XXX bill. It's marked in our packet as document 066942. 066942. And so, it's my understanding that this is just for a presentation and discussion today. There's no nothing will happen here except just to present the bill and take questions.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I ask your indulgence for a few minutes of testimony on the bill. Our scheduling could not accommodate this bill at a later date. We don't have actual possession of the bill because of the X numbers, so I would like to present it now. There are at least two or three testifiers who are here today to answer questions. Then when we, there is also an amendment that we cannot even take up, but I'd like to have that presented so that when we get the bill, we can then move it and lay it on the table for possible inclusion later on. So for right now, this is just a simple presentation.
Okay, so we will hear testimony on this proposed bill and then move on. But Representative Smith, why don't you begin with your
comments? Mr. Chairman, I just want to introduce Mr. Joel Carlson and a couple of other people. This legislation that they're going to talk to provides for the entry and enforcement of foreign jurisdiction protection orders in Minnesota, which allows the orders to have then the same effect and be enforced in the same manner as if they were issued in this state. With that, I'd ask you to recognize Joel Carlson.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson. Would you state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women. We appreciate Representative Smith bringing forward this important protection for battered women, children, and other victims of violence, and it has been a significant problem in the past, the entry of foreign orders for protection in our state courts. With us today and to provide testimony on the need for the bill, I have the Honorable Henry Buffalo, who is a tribal court judge, and the Honorable David Mingy, who is on our Minnesota Court of Appeals. I can tell you that I am aware of no opposition to this bill and the language before you. There is a correction that we need to make to the bill and members on the draft, which is 066942 on the top. We need to deal with the issue of child welfare protective orders in an additional manner. That is the amendment that Representative Smith spoke about, and we appreciate your consideration for including this in the omnibus bill. We'll be happy to answer any questions that you might have. I would also add that we have gone through this issue with DPS. Mary Olson is here from the department if you want to ask questions, but she is here to support the bill as well. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think I'd ask Judge Buffalo to provide his comments.
Welcome to our committee this morning, Judge Buffalo. Would you state your name for the record and proceed with your comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Henry Buffalo, and I'm an enrolled member of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, which are located in northern Wisconsin. I'm an attorney in private practice in town here, and I've also been a judge for the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community since 1987. I also serve in the capacity as a judge as the co-chair of the Tribal State Court Judges Forum. It's an organization that was created back in about 1994-95 that was sort of an effort to reach out to state court judges and share with them concerns that we have from the tribal bench to the state bench. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and testify in front of this committee. The thing that I'd like to focus on with the committee is the fact that this is actually just sort of a technical amendment to 518B, and it's actually an implementation thing. Our concern is that tribal orders for protection are not being entered into the systems, into the law enforcement and the state court systems, as a result of that, indeed create problems from our perspective, in that it develops loopholes in which we're concerned for the safety of both adults and children who may be affected by our orders and not having them recognized. And let me just share with you briefly three examples of, I think, that kind of a problem that has actually occurred with respect to tribal court orders. Recently, a protective order prohibiting an individual from any further contact with a family because the individual made direct written threats against the family, a situation sort of existed. The city police were present for and participated in the tribal court hearing. The city police were aware that the court issued a protective order and received a written copy of the protective order. The protective order was also entered into the county database system, which the police do not have access to. The protective order was not entered into the state database because the district court administration said there was no way to do so. The protected family received additional recorded threats and called the city police immediately. Although they spoke with the same officer that was present for the hearing who had received a copy of the tribe's executed order, and the officer indicated that she wanted to enforce the order, the police stated that they were unable to honor and enforce the order because it was not on the statewide order for protection database. In that situation, the county sheriff indicated that because of the individual's address, that was a matter to be handled by the city police. And so we kept getting passed between the different agencies. That is an example, I think, of one of the reasons why we had worked with Supreme Court personnel through the forum and the state court's technology staff and the state court administration. They communicated with the district court administration. After much education and explanation, the district court administrator understood the requirements of the law and the practical impediments to enforcement of such orders and agreed to work with the tribal court to enter our protective order. This process took a couple of weeks. In the interim, the family was left without the protections afforded and required under the federal law. A second anecdotal incident that I'd like to share with you involves the Violence Against Women's Act. Another tribal court issued a protective order prohibiting contact between a mother and her teenage child because of their explosive relationship. Mom would often remove the child from a court-ordered placement, and the two would, within a few days, often have a physical altercation. The tribal court clerk telephoned each jurisdiction that the court suspected the mother may take the child to, explained the court's order and the federal law, and urgently requested each county to enter the protective order into their system, followed, of course, by the necessary documents. Court administration would not enter the protective order into the state OFP database. Eventually, the domestic abuse program in Hennepin County, familiar with the full faith and credit requirements of the federal law, Violence Against Women's Act, found a way to enter the order into the state's database. Again, this took several days, and they indicated that they were only able to do this because the child was placed in a relative's care in Hennepin County at the time, but that they would be unable to enter such protective orders issued by the tribal court when the child was not placed in Hennepin County. A third anecdotal incident I'd like to share with you arose as a part of the Indian Child Welfare Act. In this instance, a protective order was issued for two youth who were subject to a tribal court child welfare proceeding. The youth had a history of running and when on the run, typically found a way to travel great distances around the state and getting into mischief along the way. On one particular occasion, the youth went on the run. The court received reports of their whereabouts and issued a protective pickup order based on their age. They're traveling some 200 miles away from their court-ordered placement and information related to the condition of their location. The local police were unaware of the tribal court's protective order. Since they received a copy of the order from the court and the clerk spoke directly with the police officer regarding the order, the same officer knew the youth, stopped them, had them in his squad car, and radioed dispatch. Dispatch could not verify the protective order in the state order for protection database. The police officer, knowing the order was recently issued, asked to speak to the chief. The chief directed the police officer to release the youth because there was no order in the state database, and the chief indicated that he was concerned about liability for detaining the youth without the entrance of the order in the state OFP database. The result is that the youth continued on the run for several months and caused significant damage to themselves and the property of others during this hiatus, including stealing a vehicle, driving around the state, both when neither youth were sufficient age to drive, and eventually torching the vehicle on a stranger's property. The danger posed by the lack of enforcement was realized, and it was just by luck that the youth were not severely harmed during the time that they were not protected. Even with the clear and measurable improvement in communication between and among tribal judges and state court judges, there is still no standardized system in place that would allow essentially a novice in either system to ensure enforcement of these orders. The result is a patchwork of efforts to provide protection to persons that must be, by federal statute, afforded such protections. The rule adopted by the Supreme Court in 2003, while recognizing the need to honor tribal court orders that qualify under federal law, did not provide guidance to court administrators, state court judges, or recipients of tribal court protection orders on how to obtain statewide acknowledgement of those orders. The technical capacity of the state to enter such orders is without question. This legislation will provide the guidance missing from any of the rules or statutes at this time. And with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony and again thank the committee for providing me the time.
Thank you, Judge Buffalo, for your comments. Judge Mingy, would you like to state your name for the record and begin your comments?
Thank you. I'm David Mingy. I'm a judge on the Minnesota State Court of Appeals, and I'm co-chair of the Tribal State Court Forum. I'm here this morning as an individual, not as a representative of the judiciary. I would simply echo the comments that Judge Buffalo has made, say that the forum has considered this over a three-year period, that in January of this year we did make a decision to formally request that the Minnesota Supreme Court and State Judicial Council direct the technical staff of the judiciary to enter these orders for protection, and I will be appearing tomorrow before the State Judicial Council to advance that request. I'm pleased that the legislature is considering this legislation and appreciate the opportunity to appear. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Mingy. Is there any other comments, Representative Smith, that you want to make in the presentation here?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to have an additional 15 seconds. Mr. Carlson had some testimony relative to the respondent that we would like to get on the record, and then we're prepared for any questions.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson. Would you state your name and
Mr. Chairman, Joel Carlson. Just on my notes on the bill, did want to point out to the committee that the language in the bill does provide for appropriate due process protections for the respondent to challenge and answer for an inappropriately entered or enforced OFP, and that is in the language, so that we are not taking the step of eliminating any due process rights that would be afforded anyone else that is subject to a domestic order for protection. I wanted to point that out. This is one of two policy initiatives of the MCBW. You heard Representative Meslow's issue on order for protections earlier in the week, and we appreciate your support on these issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions of the presenters here? Representative Smith, you had said there was a possible amendment that you wanted to just talk about, too. Is that something you want to bring up at this point, or are we finished?
Mr. Chairman, we already did, and it was it references lines 10 and 11 on number 1. When the appropriate time comes, we would ask that everything after the word Indian tribe, beginning with the word which, through the next line, child welfare proceedings, be deleted, correct? Simply be deleted. And that was at the request of the court. When we bring this up again and ask for action at the time, we'll do a little more explaining on that point.
Other than that, we would thank you for the opportunity to present it.
Okay, thank you. And we will proceed to the next bill on the agenda this morning, which is House File 2829. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 2829 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, the bill is before us. Did you want to do some amendments before you make your presentation? Or
yes.
Did you, okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have two author's amendments that I'd like to add on, and if we could just put them on, I will explain them afterwards. It may be an easier way to do it.
Okay, and they are the
A4 and the A2-1 amendments.
Okay, first of all, the A2-1 amendment. Representative Johnson moves that we adopt the A2-1 amendment. Any questions on the A2-1? All those in favor of adopting the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, that amendment is adopted. And then the, which is the other one, the A4?
A4.
Okay, Representative Johnson moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the A4 is on the bill. So the bill is as you want it. Why don't you go ahead and present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a few introductory remarks. I'll talk briefly about what the bill says, and then I'm going to ask Mr. O'Malley to give a short presentation. This bill has to do with child pornography issues, and it's actually very timely. I don't know if any of you read the paper this morning, but I printed it off from the New York Times actually this morning. 27 people in 9 states were arrested in an internet child pornography ring that the U.S. Attorney General says is one of the worst they've ever discovered. And included, they identified 7 children who were molested on streaming video that was traded over the internet, including one who was less than 18 months old who was being actually sexually molested, and this is being traded over the internet. And the Julie Myers, who's an assistant secretary for the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, points out in this article that she said the case reflects 3 larger trends that are becoming more common in child pornography rings. One is the increasing prevalence of homegrown pornographic images that are produced by predators themselves and include live streaming video images of children being molested, not just the circulation of pictures over and over again. Another trend is the growing use of sophisticated security measures and of peer-to-peer networking over the internet so that people can share pictures or videos without actually downloading them, and it's much tougher to find them. And then the third trend is the increasingly violent and graphic nature of the images involving the molesting of younger children. So I think the bill and a bill that Representative Hillstrom is going to follow up with are very timely today. Let me just tell you what the bill does. It actually, based upon the amendments, has 2 somewhat distinct pieces. And the first piece, which is the A4 amendment and what is already in the bill, creates a new penalty essentially for individuals who in positions of authority, which essentially is, you know, coaches or teachers or mentors, people who work with children and are there to provide help with children. It creates a crime that says if they are in that position of authority and they use the organization's resources to either disseminate or possess child pornography, they are given a mandatory minimum sentence, 3 years for possession, 5 years for dissemination. The amendment also provides a mandatory minimum sentence of 6 months for possession or dissemination of child pornography, regardless of whether you're in a position of authority with respect to children or not. And then you'll also see that the amendment ranks the crimes of possession, dissemination, or the use of a child in a sexual performance on the grid, on the sentencing grid. Currently, these crimes are unranked, and so we can be all over the board. And I will ask Mr. Deeble in a minute to explain to you where we're putting them on the grid. Let me just say this part of the bill arose based upon a case in Moorhead where a elementary school social worker was found to have 26 child pornography images on his computer and disseminating at least one of them. And he was convicted of a felony charge of disseminating child pornography, but he got no jail time. It was all a stayed sentence, and actually, if he doesn't get in trouble in the next 3 years, he's going to end up with a misdemeanor on his record. There's been a lot of coverage in the Fargo-Moorhead on this. People are rather upset about it, and of course, bashing on the judge, frankly, for it. And some people have pointed out that maybe we shouldn't bash on the judge. Maybe this is the legislature's fault. Maybe we just haven't given the right guidelines or legislative requirements to judges, and I think they might be right. We need to fix that, and that's what this bill is trying to do. Essentially, what we're saying is there's really no reason whatsoever that someone like an elementary school social worker who disseminates child pornography should not serve some time. That's what this bill would require. The second piece of the bill, which is the A21 amendment, provides funding for something that the governor proposed yesterday or the day before, the creation of an Internet Crimes Against Children team under the BCA to investigate technologically facilitated crimes against kids, essentially Internet child pornography. And Representative Hillstrom and I on Tuesday night visited the St. Paul Command Center, essentially, for the ICAC unit. And we spent actually several hours there with some other people, including the two that are sitting next to me, and got an eyeful and an earful. It was fascinating. It was creepy. And maybe with that, I will turn it over to our testifiers to talk about this issue and their unit a little more broadly, if that's all right, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Johnson, please.
My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the Assistant Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present some information on this important topic. I'm here with Rick Anderson, who's associated with the National Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. And what we would propose doing, with your permission, sir, is to, we have about 10 slides. I think it would take 5 to 10 minutes to go through it. First, setting the problem, the nature of the problem in context, and I will do that. And then Commander Anderson will follow up with what we think might be a law enforcement solution, a proposal of how to respond to this problem.
Please proceed.
Thank you. The information, this first slide is just to set the stage as to what we're talking about, but the important stat on this one, I think, is just that we have to recognize there are 77 million children a year that go online. And these are a wide range of children in terms of ages. They're younger and younger every year. Of those children that go online, one out of every four is exposed to some type of sexual material that they didn't want to see. Children, by their nature, are curious. When we were all kids, we'd go to the park, we'd explore, we'd do things. There is that same curiosity exists today, only they're in their home, they're in their school where they feel safe, and now they're cruising around online. And they know more about the Internet than most adults, and they know how to navigate it, and they'll explore some things and come across some things that they didn't intend to find. Of those 77 million, one out of every five is sexually solicited somehow. There is an exchange of communication. There's some type of an Internet communication that takes place between usually an adult and a child, and it has to do with solicitation for sex. This is one of the most startling statistics I think I've ever seen. Of those 77 million, one in every 33 receives what's been defined as an aggressive solicitation. So that means one out of every 33 children that goes online, they either have the offender, the person they're talking to, either tries to meet with them, suggests that they get together personally, talks to them on the phone, gets them directly talking to them, or sends them something in the mail, some kind of a gift or a present to entice them to meet. You can see in the past several years this issue has really exploded. This is from the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, the number of cases nationwide. The distribution of pornography cases in 2003 that was reported was 768. A year later, it's 9,700. The manufacturing of child pornography. If you have a predator, somebody with that mindset, and they have a digital camera and a computer, it's all they need nowadays. They can create child pornography, and then they can exchange it on the Internet. And you can see the jump in cases there in a one-year period. Of those pornographic images that are out there, child pornography, here's the age range of the children depicted in those images. Over 80% are kids between the ages of 6 and 12. It adds up to over 100% because many of the photos have multiple children in them. But that's the breakdown of the ages of the kids. Of all these photos, 80% of those photos show a child being penetrated, sexually being penetrated. 21% of those photos depict some kind of violent act, and they define that as torture, bondage, or more than just penetration, that most of us in layman's terms would consider a rape. of violent physical assault. What happens to these children? They're very young, they're curious, they're lured into this. Studies have now been done by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to track some of these kids and see how it affects them long term. And this is the kind of result that happens with some of them. Not all of them, but with some of them. I can tell you that we talked about, is there some way we can capture this visually for you? Is there something we could show you? Representative Hillstrom and Representative Johnson got a touch of it the other night. But it would be against the law for us to show you child pornography. I mean, that's the purpose, right? But some of us in the room have worked these cases, and I personally have, and I can to this day remember very vividly the first search warrant I did where there was child pornography there. And one of the photos taken was of a four-year-old girl sitting on top of an adult male who had his penis in her vagina. And I could see her. You can't help but notice that, right? I mean, your eyes are going to be drawn to that. But what's seared in my mind to this day is her face. She's looking right at the camera, and the eyes are just vacant. And I have no idea what happened to her to this day, but I can't imagine it's a good thing when at 4 or 5 years old that happens to you. In Minnesota, just to give you an idea of what might be around the state, we ran a search yesterday on the registered sex offenders within the state, and we just ran it with the, we have a way of determining what kind of, how their criminal behavior, what tools they use, what they do, whether it's a knife or if it's involves children, but ones that involve children and that had the word internet as part of their MO, if you will. This is where there were 136, I believe, of the registered offenders that actually we know as part of their process for trying to find children, they use the internet, and this is where they're located in Minnesota. With that, I'll turn it over to Commander Anderson to talk about what we think could be done.
Welcome, sir. Give us your name again and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Rick Anderson. I'm actually the former commander of the Minnesota Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force, which is based out of the St. Paul Police Department. It currently still exists. The current commander is unavailable today and asked me to step in and talk about the program. I'm also a training coordinator for the undercover component of the National Internet Crimes Against Children program. The Department of Justice funds a program which consists of 46 task forces across the country who target internet investigations involving children. In other words, online pornography and solicitation of our children for sexual purposes. St. Paul Police Department received a grant in 2000 for that purpose, and to this day there's about 16 agencies in Minnesota that are affiliated with the St. Paul Police Department's program, and also the state of South Dakota. It falls under Minnesota purview, and North Dakota is actually coming on board also. So it's a national program. It works very well together investigating these type of crimes. What needs to kind of happen, though, is there's some issues that happen with St. Paul Police Department as far as them overseeing a statewide organization, is we need to get further involvement by the BCA. We refer cases out all around the state of Minnesota. Currently, the task force members do not have statewide jurisdiction. And when we refer to another agency, we're basically sending them case information, but we're doing what we can to assist them in facilitating that investigation. If the state does move ahead and provide some funds to the BCA to get involved in this type of thing, they would have statewide investigators to assist with the investigations that jump from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and they would also have some funding to assist in doing some of the computer forensics. Because these type of crimes, when you do these investigations, you seize a computer, and they have to be examined by a competent forensic analyst. Currently, the backlog in St. Paul for the Minnesota ITAC is about 6 months to get a computer looked at. When you think about it, there's images of children being molested on there. One of our biggest fears is that if we seize a computer in that 6 months while we're waiting to get it looked at, that a child is continuing to be molested by the person we seized it from, because obviously they're not going to be in custody that entire time. So the purpose of this would be to get some serious resources brought against this issue. It continues to grow, the need for investigators and forensic analysis of these computers, and to work with the national program as far as taking cases from one state to another. As you can well imagine, if we initiate a case in Minnesota, we're not sure that it's going to end up in Minnesota. It could end up in another state. Well, there's a task force in another state that we can refer them to, and we have the same type of thing, where somebody in Georgia, for instance, might be online in an undercover capacity and have somebody sending them child pornography. They'll do some research to find out that person actually is in Minnesota. They refer that to us, and then we make the appropriate actions in getting the local jurisdiction involved in that case and going after it. It's a very well-run program. the BCA would be a wonderful addition to get that a true commitment in the state of Minnesota to do this. Of the 46 task forces around the country, Minnesota is a little unique in the fact that we're actually run by a local agency. Most of the other states are typically run out of their equivalent of the BCA, DCI, Department of Criminal Investigation, or their Attorney General's offices. So we've had numerous cases in Minnesota. A couple examples, I'll give you a couple quick ones that we've dealt with. We had a cyber tip that came in, was in the Wilmer, Minnesota area, that came in from the East Coast, that this gentleman there was downloading child pornography. We did an investigation, actually identified the individual, referred the case to the Wilmer Police Department. They executed a search warrant and did indeed find child pornography in the home, found that there were underage juveniles living in the home that had ran from the home, and he was actually kind of befriending them. Turns out he was very prominent in local youth activities. He obviously later pled guilty to possession of child porn. We were never able to establish that he had actually molested anybody himself. However, the signs were all there that may have happened. Another case that kind of has statewide implications is the Mankato member of the ICAC task force from Mankato Department of Public Safety got a tip of that a young lady had pictures taken of her. His investigation lasted almost a year, if not longer. Five suspects ended up being arrested. Seven juveniles were identified that the suspects had actually developed a sex ring where they were taking pictures and preparing to sell those on the internet. Search warrants were done in multiple jurisdictions. Without the coordination and the efforts of the ICAC task force, it would have been very difficult to have gotten that accomplished. So it's something that it runs rampant around the state, and we need a coordinated effort to make sure that these investigations are handled in a timely manner.
Thank you, Commander. Are there any questions at this point? If not, do we have an additional testifier, Representative Johnson?
Yes, I believe Ms. Ferrucci is here to testify as well. Can I just add one thing while she's coming up? When Representative Hillstrom and I were there on Tuesday night, one thing that we got to see, they do several things that we can't really talk about because we don't really want to reveal that, but one thing that Mr. Anderson showed us was he got on into a chat room and identified himself essentially as a 39-year-old single mother with two little kids, and within 5 minutes he had somebody responding and asking if she had any interest in, quote, family fun, which apparently is one of the keywords for having sex with your kids. That's about how long it took, if I remember right, to have, and people were swarming in response.
Representative Johnson, we also have, Isabel Judge Gomez here. Good. We'll get to you next. We have, is there anyone else in this room who is present wanting to testify on this bill for or against besides the name I just mentioned? Please raise your hand. Any testifiers? Okay, we have two more witnesses. Be mindful of the time and go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Smith, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify on behalf of this bill. My name is Carla Ferrucci, and I'm with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and we're a coalition of service providers and victims and survivors of sexual violence. The two testifiers before me articulated the scope of this problem, so I'm just going to illuminate it a little bit further, and I'll be brief. Where there is child pornography, there are always victims. And the distribution of that depiction repeats that victimization over and over long after the incident took place. So these victims are being re-victimized throughout their lifetime because it's out there forever. Additionally, when the face of a child is superimposed, even if they're not involved in the case, when they create digital imagery of a sexual act, it also gives that victim, even though they didn't participate in it or weren't physically touched, they're still victimized throughout their lifetime with the distribution of that image. There are two ways in which children are harmed by child pornography, and they, again, already spoke to this, but by being exposed to child pornography or being filmed themselves. Children who are exposed to child pornography are in danger of being desensitized and seduced into believing that pornographic activity is normal for children. Involvement in child pornography provides a sort of modeling that adversely affects children's behavior and results in the child connecting sex to exploitation, force, and violence. The impact on a child victim who is exploited to produce pornography is often serious. Children experience a myriad of symptoms, including symptoms that are physical and illnesses, as well as emotional withdrawal, antisocial behavior, mood swings, depression, fear, and anxiety. Another impact on children who are sexually abused or exploited is that they are at higher risk of teen pregnancy, chemical dependency, obesity, attempted suicides, and victimization in later life. So these are long-term public health issues that we are burdened with long after the abuse occurs. Additionally, victims of child sexual abuse and exploitation are also at a greater risk of becoming perpetrators and abusers themselves. Because of the extensive lifelong impact of being exploited, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault supports House File 2829.
Ms. Frucci and Judge Gomez, please. Yes.
I should say the judge is not in the room. I am Isabel Gomez. I recently retired after 22 years on the Hennepin County bench to become director of the Sentencing Guidelines Committee, and it is on behalf or commission, and it is on behalf of the commission that I am here to testify, or rather, actually came not so much to testify as to comment on the bill as we had it yesterday. I have much less to say about the bill since there have been some very significant amendments which addressed a lot of the concerns of the commission. Now, I simply want to remind the committee that the commission, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, is the institution that is in charge of maintaining the goals and policies of the sentencing guidelines and of Minnesota's criminal sentencing system, and also making sure that the guidelines capture the law as the legislature passes it and the reality of the crimes that are punished under those laws. The commission is chaired by Sheriff Steve Borchardt of Olmsted County, whom a lot of you know. There are three judicial members. I was appointed by then-Chief Glass in 2002 and served on the commission. Now we have two judges appointed by Chief Glass and one by Chief Anderson. The remaining eight members of the commission were appointed by Governor Pawlenty. I have brought with me today, and I'm going to leave with you, our packet on the proposed sex offender sentencing grid, which you may remember, some of you, from last year. I know that you're rushed today, and I am not here to present the grid. However, I hope that you will invite me back to do that and to answer any questions that the committee might have. I simply want to say about this sex offender proposal that the reason we came up with it was because it was clear to us that the basic grid did not provide adequately severe sanctions for serious sex offenders, and very importantly, that it did not capture in any way the significance of repeat offenses. And I'll have a lot more to say about that if you invite me back. But the whole point of the grid is to move repeat offenders to the maximum much more quickly than the basic grid. As you can imagine, the grid does have a substantial bed impact. The commission is convinced that the bed impact is justified by the amount of damage that the people who are captured in this grid do to the community, and justified by public safety issues, and absolutely consonant with the sentencing guidelines principles in that they also are very proportionate. And so I don't want to go on about that. I do want to say, though, that we hope, the commission hopes, that you will not make any changes in rankings or until you have come to grips with the proposed scheme, because these offenses that particularly, I was here to talk about the possession and dissemination of pornography offenses, those offenses were the subject of a lot of discussion by the commission. Generally, the commission's sex offender proposal has been very widely praised. In fact, we have had no negative reactions from anybody about the grid as a whole. The only testimony that we had concerning the grid came from two very splendid prosecutors, one Judy Johnson from Hennepin County and Gene Schley from Ramsey County, who testified on behalf of their offices concerning the child pornography issues. Their testimony was very influential on the commission and the way the offenses are handled on the grid was definitely partly resulted from their suggestions. Now, as to the necessity to rank things in order to get sufficient sentences, as a former judge, I wouldn't let that judge off the hook. You know, the legislature gave the judge a maximum. If the maximum, if the judge didn't use it, and anybody wants to be critical of the sentence, you know, the buck stops with judges when it comes to sentencing. Frankly, if this committee's desire is to make it easier for people who possess or disseminate pornography to get longer sentences, probably the solution would be for them not to be ranked at all. You know, generally, that because if they're not ranked, then the judge can go to the max, can rank them wherever the judge sees fit on that day. Now, generally, the commission has not, in the past, been told by the legislature where to rank things. And generally, offenses, new offenses, are not ranked because we have no experience of knowing who are these people until some of them have been prosecuted. So if you look at page 1 of the handout that I prepared for the committee, and I apologize to people here that didn't have extra copies, you'll see a chart showing the prosecution, the cases prosecuted of possession and dissemination of pornography. And what you see, of course, is that at the front end, there weren't any to speak of because it's a brand new law. And it took a couple of years for us to get to a point where we've seen enough cases to be able to have a sense of how they should be ranked. The chart shows where the cases were actually handled by judges. I will say that prosecutors are probably, at least in the metropolitan jurisdictions where they have a lot of cases, prosecutors really do drive the sentencing of these offenses because they're able to come in, that is when they're unranked, because they're able to come in and say, Judge, our office has handled 35 of these people, and this is where they've been handled, this is where we think they should be handled, this is where we want you to handle them. That's a reasonable argument. You know, if I hear 30 of my colleagues did X and on similar cases, this is important to me. And so that's the fact that these offenses, the possession and dissemination, are where they are in terms of where they cluster, is very much prosecutor-driven, and I think it's important that people understand that. Now, I know that I'm here to testify to the commission. The commission is not a person, but here I sit. And I think it is important whenever anyone, when I'm trying to evaluate somebody's input, to know who they are. The fact of the matter is that I have, I think it's very important, the commission thinks it's very important, which is why I'm going there, to separate imagery and manipulation of imagery, which is very serious, a huge problem, from sexually violating children, which is a worse problem. The cases, I was in the juvenile court for 5 years in Hennepin County. I saw infants with gonorrhea of 6 months old, 7 months old, and many various and appalling sexual acts committed on utterly innocent people. So I'm not one, nor is anybody on the commission, to take these matters lightly. I will say that in 22 years, I saw autopsy videos and crime scene photos and autopsy stills of more than 100 dead human beings, the youngest of whom was 6 months old. As I sit here today, those images I have been able to drop. The images I have not been able to drop are six images which Judy Johnson showed me in a child pornography case. They were so transgressive that they are still in my head, despite or notwithstanding all the other stuff that's in my experience. So in making these comments, I want to make it clear that neither I nor the commission in any way underrates the seriousness of involved in child pornography. Our concern is that the proposed rankings are disproportionate. Proportionality is the guidelines' goal. We want similarly serious offenses to be sentenced similarly, and less serious offenses to receive less serious sentences. Child pornography is appalling. Really, it's impossible to come up with adjectives, frankly. But raping children is worse. And the concern that from the guidelines point of view is that the proposed bill in commanding these rankings puts those possession dissemination offenses in the same boxes as crimes involving actual convictions, findings of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt for sexually violating children. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions, Representative Ellison?
Mr. Chair, I think it's impossible for me to call you anything but Judge Gomez.
I was so hoping to get my first name back.
As you know, I've appeared in front of you many times. It's kind of an old habit, and I don't know if I'll be able to break it. But Mrs. Gomez, Ms. Gomez, my first shot at that. How many are we looking at? What's the rate of departures for these sort of possession of child pornography cases? Are we seeing judges downward depart or upward, or what do we see?
So up until now, there has been no departure issue because they were unranked.
Okay.
So the judge could handle every offense as it came in, anywhere from top to bottom. And so there was no presumptive sentence. There was nothing forbidding a judge from sending someone directly to prison. And so that's what I meant when I say if you leave them unranked, that possibility is there. I'm not saying what you should do, but in fact, ranking them is problematical both because the proposed rankings, I think the commission's view would be disproportionate. In the case of the use of minors in sexual performance, which sadly is never prosecuted, we ranked it because we were ranking everything. And we put it where it belonged, given the statutory maximum for that offense. Really, if one thinks deliberately about what that offense would be, the statutory maximum probably should be higher. I mean, now I shouldn't say that, because that's up to the legislature. But it certainly would not be disproportional for the statutory maximum for people who are actually putting kids into these situations. Would be higher than the statutory maximum for people who are buying and selling the images. So up till now, there haven't been any departure issue. And on that, using minors, the commission has no experience, cannot do anything to help you with that because there haven't been prosecutions, so we don't have any history.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
Now, if it were ranked, and if an egregious case came in that the judge felt, or the prosecutor, I guess, felt needed to be sentenced above the guideline, the ranked guideline, wouldn't that require then a separate jury trial in order to get a higher sentence, or am I misunderstanding the situation?
It would, Ms. Gomez? Under the new Blakely law visited upon us by the United States Supreme Court, departing upward did become harder, but it's not that hard. I recently, before, in my old job, departed big time on a predatory sex offender, and that process took us an additional hour and a half. It took the jury came in, found him guilty. The judge and the attorneys, I and the attorneys discussed what kinds of instructions we needed to give the jury in terms of finding enhancing factors, things that would justify an upward departure. We got the instructions together. We gave it to the jury. The attorneys argued for 15 or 20 minutes because the jury had just heard the whole catastrophe, and it took the jury 20 minutes to find all the aggravating factors. So in a trial situation, it's not that hard. And if you're bargaining, you bargain where you need to bargain.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, thank you for bringing the bill forward, and thank you for inviting me to attend the demonstration on Tuesday night. One thing that I learned is that many people send child pornography to a child in an attempt to desensitize them and see if they would be interested in meeting. And the goal is to catch that person prior to the contact. And so I really think that it's important that we do discuss these crimes and how we would like them sentenced, because ultimately the goal would be to, when this person attempts to arrange the meeting, that you can get them significantly for the distribution of the child pornography rather than waiting until after the crime has been committed against the child. So I would assume that this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion, and I hope that we continue to have very positive discussions about how we might address some of these issues. I was appalled at what I saw. I was very concerned about how quickly it goes from a quiet, calm conversation to a very aggressive manipulation. So thank you, Representative Johnson.
Representative Paymar.
Representative Johnson, can you respond to the testimony by Ms. Gomez?
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar. Part of my response was the amendment, and what was first recommended to us, and the bill that I took, Representative Lanning actually brought this to me because of what happened in Moorhead, and it was difficult for him to carry it because he knew some of the players involved. And so I said I would be happy to, and what we started out with was much higher than what we ended up with. And essentially, if you look at the proposed sex offender grid, what we have done is we've bumped up the dissemination of child pornography from E to D, so one box. And we've bumped up the possession of child pornography from F to E, one box. And they are, I mean, we are ranking dissemination with contact. But especially after hearing what the experts were telling us the other night, is how this is almost always a gateway to that. Looking at and disseminating child pornography seems to almost always lead to the actual act of molestation of children. It seems to me that increasing this one box is reasonable.
Representative Pimmer?
Could I ask Ms. Gomez if she could respond to that?
Yes, you can do that. Ms. Gomez?
The commission can't. And I would be, I get uncomfortable because I'm here for the commission in the judge saying things about what the judge knows. But to my knowledge, that it sounds good. So now I was going to answer you. Okay, I'll do it now. This is my ninth day. Next week I can't do the thing. I don't know what the research is concerning movement of people from consumers of these images into acting out on children. I would expect, though, that based on the research that I do know about sex offenders, which is a lot, may not happen so often, because when I've seen these people prosecuted, they seem in many ways to be substituting the images, but whatever. That is something that should not be answered except based on research, and I'm not sure what the research is. I will say, however, if you look at it the other way around, and you look at perpetrators of child abuse, sexual abuse, they certainly surround themselves with these images. So they're certainly present with the offenders, but I don't know that they lead to offending. That's a different matter.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Representative Johnson, what are the prisoners going to be doing in the 3 years that they're locked up?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, I guess I don't know. They're going to do what any other prisoner does, I would assume, which is, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
I'm not going anywhere. We're putting these people in prison for 3 years. What are they going to be doing from the first day to the third to the last day during those 3 years that will make them any different than they were before they went in?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, I don't think there's any element of treatment in my amendment, but my hope is that there would be some of that. I know if they're in jail, they won't be doing anything to children, at the very least. But I understand your point of you put them in jail for 3 years, are they just going to come out and start looking at or disseminating child pornography again? And the hope is that maybe there would be more to this than just that.
Representative Murphy?
But Mr. Chairman, they're going to be in prison, not jail.
Representative right. Johnson.
Right.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy?
So, and we don't have a component for treatment in there.
In the amendment, I don't believe there's a component for treatment. No.
No.
Not in the bill.
And so... not very productive 3 years.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Johnson. Representative Murphy. Productive, I don't know if that's the point of prison or jail time. I do know that, I guess, if they are in a position of authority with children and they are looking at or disseminating child pornography, to me, having them in prison for a period of time is a good thing. Whether it's productive or not, I'm not sure, but I would be pretty darn concerned about having them out in the public and working with kids.
Seeing no further questions, I think the chair will lay this bill on the table and for future consideration at a future time. The last bill on the agenda that we're going to take up today is House File 2837. It is almost time for the committee to end, but session isn't until 3 o'clock, so we're going to continue and hear this bill.
We haven't had lunch for 2 days.
And if you have another obligation and you need to slip out, you can do that. But Representative Hillstrom will be looking at House File 2837. Also. The bill is intended to lay the bill over for possible consideration at a future time. So, Representative Hillstrom, would you like to introduce your testifiers and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 2837 is a bill that is very much like what we did in House File 1 with other crimes. We took some of the more serious offenses, and we added some conditional release time. This issue was brought to me by Ms. O'Neill, and I would like her to talk to you a little bit about what she does and what her perspective is.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. O'Neill. Would you state your name for the record and begin your testimony?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Hannah O'Neill. I'm a probation officer with Hennepin County Sex Offender Unit. I've been with the Sex Offender Unit in Hennepin County since its inception. Since about 2000, convictions in the state of Minnesota for the possession or dissemination of child pornography has increased about 600%. The average sentence that we're seeing is 18-month stayed, meaning the offenders will do some small amount of jail time and then have an 18-month sentence hanging over their heads. During that time, they'll hopefully complete their court-ordered probation conditions. Of the cases that we are currently supervising in Hennepin County, approximately 25% have admitted that they have contact victims that were never reported or charged, and 35% of them are struggling with meeting their court-ordered conditions, which could ultimately result in them being sent to prison. The reason I make these points is to illustrate that, number one, when we have this new class of sex offenders on probation, we don't know what we're dealing with. Only after polygraph and psychometric testing do we really know what level of risk this offender poses in the community. Number two, these offenders are getting extremely light sentences. And number three, potentially 35% of them could end up in prison. I tie this information into an example of an offender I had on probation. He was arrested for possessing and disseminating 15,000 images of child pornography. He pled guilty to 6 counts of possession and dissemination and was given a stayed sentence of 23 months. He went to an outpatient sex offender treatment program and was eventually terminated for again accessing child pornography, this time at work. That case was never charged. After a probation revocation hearing and some additional workhouse time, the offender entered into a residential treatment, sex offender treatment program. Following both polygraph and psychometric testing, he was diagnosed with actual pedophilia. After close to 2 years in treatment, residential treatment, the offender was again terminated. This time for several reasons, one of being he was following little girls around in the malls for the purposes of arousal. His probation was revoked and he was sentenced to 23 months in prison. After all the jail credit was totaled, he actually served 84 days in prison. He was released as a level 2 sex offender and has 7 months of parole, which is about to expire in June, I believe. In essence, we returned an untreated pedophile back into the community without supervision. If the 5-year conditional release period were in place for this offender, it would allow a significant period of supervision and hopefully an added layer of community safety. This legislation would likely not affect a large number of offenders, but would provide a safety net for the most dangerous of offenders that would otherwise fall through the cracks. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Ms. O'Neill, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another example that was given to me is in the event that someone actually does go to prison and they don't earn any of their good time and they actually serve their full sentence, currently we do not have the ability to supervise them once they get out. So the worse behaved you are, the more likely it is that you're not supervised when you get out. And so this just says we would like 5 years on the first offense that we may put conditions on and 10 years on the second offense.
Okay, any questions or comments from the committee? Seeing none, maybe we will get on time. The chair lays House File 2837 on the table for future consideration. And
thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Okay. Okay, we have an announcement here that Mr. Gill is going to give us.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Gilder, the committee staff. Chairman Smith asked me to announce that on Tuesday, the committee will meet in this room at 10:15. The committee will start with the Department of Corrections deficiency request. Then there will be 4 bills we hope will be heard before noon. The committee will reconvene at 4:30 in room 10. The chairman is mindful that Tuesday night is Rochester night, so we will try to be disciplined in our time. It's the chairman's plan to do a brief presentation on the bill, House File 3308, the omnibus immigration and identity theft bill, and then to allocate 1 hour each for the proponents and opponents of the bill. Representative Ellison mentioned that several potential witnesses have contacted him. I will get those names from him, and we will do our best to allocate those slots. There were 20 witnesses and 4 hours of testimony on this bill in local government. There were 12 witnesses and 2 hours of testimony in civil law, and the chairman will do his best to allocate and provide fairness in the process.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just parts of this bill were heard in local government, and so not all of the provisions were, and so I would be interested to find out which pieces have not been present in any of the committees, because this committee may want to focus on some of those areas more closely.
Okay, so we can have that information when we the bill is before us. So seeing no other business today, this meeting stands adjourned.